This morning, we're interviewing Kim Roney, a Nashville City Council member who is running for the mayoralty of Asheville. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. So glad to be here with y'all today.
Yeah.
Good morning.
We're going to dive right into these questions now. My first overarching question is, what convinced you to run for mayor this year?
So I've been attending meetings since December 9th, 2014. I've sat in the press row. I've served on boards and commissions. I have been in the audience while decisions are being made about us without us. I'm very concerned about the exclusionary nature of a lot of our meetings. And I feel very strongly that my commitment to an open meetings policy can help support the public being able to bring professional and lived experience to the table around key issues, around public safety, around affordability, around a meaningful action around climate response, and homelessness. And when we have our meetings behind the scenes instead of in the public, or documents that are not easily accessible in advance of the meetings, then we're limiting ourselves from our greatest resource, which is our people power.
Thank you. Some residents support using tax incentives to encourage employers such as Pratt & Whitney to come to Buncombe County. Others say the tax incentives are too large and that such industries are bolstering the military-industrial complex. What is your position and why?
So I think for me, I'm looking for us to get the greatest benefits for our community while mitigating harms that have historically and currently been taking place. In the situation of Pratt & Whitney, that was a decision that was in the county's position, but we had a recent one that came to the Asheville City Council. So in this situation, it looked like an economic development opportunity that looked, smelled, and tasted like Amazon Distribution Center. It was meant to be about $15 an hour jobs, and we don't have a lot of resources of land for us to use for that kind of size of economic development. So I voted against it. I felt like we weren't getting the jobs that we needed. It was a ton of traffic and I didn't see the benefit for it, but also what were we getting out of the incentives? So thankfully, though it passed, it failed at the bank. So what are we going to get next that could be good paying jobs that meet the needs of our community, that mitigate maybe not having as much traffic? And or what are the kind of jobs that we're bringing to the region, not just for right now, but for a hopeful future, for future generations? And I think that's what our community is demanding and looking for, is not just the best that we can get, but what we deserve.
All right. Kim, the city of Asheville and Buncombe County joined a class action antitrust lawsuit against HCA Healthcare, seeking injunctive relief and damages resulting from alleged anti-competitive practices. Do you support that lawsuit? And if so, why? Or if not, why?
Absolutely support us standing up for competitive access to healthcare in our region. There's limitations to what I can say because we are in an active lawsuit. I did vote to join the lawsuit. But I think when we look at what options are available for people and the quality of care and making sure that we have safe staffing levels for our nurses and for the people that are seeking care, those are the kinds of ways that government needs to stand up for the people in the region. So I absolutely support us joining the lawsuit.
Thank you. County Commissioner Amanda Edwards called for a walkout of North Carolina teachers as a part of a push for higher pay. Would you support such a call?
So as a music educator that works with 34 families across 12 schools in Asheville and Buncombe County, and someone who's endorsed by the Asheville City and Buncombe County Associations of Educators, I'm going to lean on and rely on the experience of our educators and feedback from our students and families. And while I'm not hearing that call from our educators and students at this time, I do understand and support that organized labor and collective action are so powerful in getting what we need. Right now, we saw North Carolina hold on to a $6 billion deficit while we have great need in our community. And especially for education across North Carolina. So when we had the deficit in transportation funding, it was really easy for the General Assembly to loosen up that 2% of the sales tax to meet the need for transportation. And it was a missed opportunity at the same time to loosen up the sales tax for paying our educators, especially when the cost of living is jumping across the state and teachers' wages have remained stagnant and not met this moment. So I'm going to keep listening to the associations of educators and students and families on what organization and strategy looks like to make sure that we get our staff paid. And that's the best answer that I have right now, because I'm not hearing the call for a strike yet, but I'm ready to join at any moment.
Kim, you said deficit a couple of times. I think you meant surplus, right? The state, the legislature has failed to utilize a surplus.
We have a surplus at the state level, but there was a deficit in transportation funding. So okay. We had about a $900 million deficit in transportation funding in Western North Carolina, because during the pandemic, folks didn't drive as much. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our transportation funding happens through gas tax. So we were down, we had a deficit in funding, but also cost of transportation planning projects was increasing at the same time. So that's what led us to a transportation deficit. What I would suggest is that because we used our surplus to meet the transportation deficit, we also could have used our surplus to meet our education needs.
That's crystal clear. Thank you. All right, moving along. If the Patriot Front or similar white supremacist group were to show up and march in Asheville, as mayor, how would you respond to that?
You know, these are really trying times in our community. I'm always going to support, and I think we have an obligation to support the right to gather and assemble and to march and freedom of speech. I think there is also an obligation to speak up for the most vulnerable in our community. I think that that would be an appropriate time to hear a statement about how Asheville is a welcoming place and that we care for each other and what our community values are. But it is important for us to protect the right to assemble and the right to free speech.
And if that group were to become disruptive, to physically disrupt and or attack, especially a minority group, like they have it at, they tried to attack a Pride Festival in Idaho earlier this year, what would your response be?
That would be a great time to listen to the community about what response should look like. And also it is the mayor's role to enact emergency declarations. So I would work really closely with staff to look like what a appropriate safety response would be. I just want to name too, that during the uprisings of 2020, we tear gassed members of the public and people were harmed and injured by our response. So it's really important to look at the outcomes of our response. And who's most vulnerable. It is absolutely important for us to protect and make sure that all the people of Asheville are safe. And while we're doing that, to make sure that we assess the ripple effects very quickly. So these are the kinds of preparations and work that can be done at the Public Safety Committee, which I'm a member of, and working closely with teams of public safety outreach across sectors. So not just policing, but also fire, EMT, EMS, Buncombe County Community paramedicine, and folks who are doing mutual aid work on the ground. When we only rely on one or two of those services instead of bringing everyone to the table, we have missing elements and we're unable to analyze the ripple effects of what our actions are. So for me, it looks like making sure we have a public safety response that meets the needs of the moment, but also it's important for us to diversify our public safety response so we send the right person with the right tools and training for the task at hand, such as a crisis like this would be, and making sure that we have a plan in advance is important.
Okay. Last summer, both Asheville and Buncombe County passed resolutions intended to make amends for generations of discrimination. What sort of reparations funding would you like to see implemented here, and for whom?
Right now, we are in a process of listening and repairing harms done specifically around urban renewal and redlining and the loss to the community, especially the Black community that was harmed by loss of land, homes, churches, education centers, grocery stores, businesses. And so when I think about the for whom, I think that we're right now we're listening to that who that whom is and what repair can look like. When we talk about the funding arm, which was how the question started, I've been attending the Community Reparations Commission meetings as much as possible and listening to the archives, the meetings. Their very first recommendation was that we earmark a percentage of the budget in perpetuity. So my ask to the city attorney's office was, what would it look like if we had a policy similar to our general fund balance? The general fund balance makes it so that you set aside a percentage of a municipal budget so that you can pay the bills even if you don't have revenue. So it's like having 2 or 3 months of savings so that you can pay your bills if you're in a crisis. Because we have a percentage policy in our general fund balance, if we matched that, and it sounds like it may be a legal option, at 1% of the city's budget and potentially say 3% of the county's budget, those would grow exponentially as our city and county budgets grow. And I think that matches closely with what the Community Reparations Commission is suggesting. Right now, both the city and the county have come to the table with a flat amount of $500,000 a year. I do think that reparations are both possible and necessary for the harms that have been done in our community. And I'm going to stay listening to the Community Reparations Commission so that we can do this important work together. But it sounds like it's time for us to mark a percentage of the budget. And if we hear that the cost is too great, then I think that we need to think about the long-term cost of not doing the work to get in right relationship with each other. And so I'm ready to get the work done on a percentage of the budget marked in perpetuity, which we haven't done yet.
Okay.
All right. Kim, the top two goals in Buncombe County's strategic plan are to increase the stock of affordable housing and to preserve green space and view sheds. How do you see those goals playing out in Asheville?
You know, I think right now, as the liaison to the Urban Forestry Commission, I just want to start with some gratitude that they worked for 5 years with a lot of support in the community to advocate for urban forester. And by bringing neighborhood resiliency as a strategic goal of council, a strategic priority of council during the retreat, that set into motion getting the urban forester funded in this budget cycle. It would not have happened with any one person doing that work. And so that's, I feel like, a good example of what happens when the community comes together to get important work done. That said, there's a lot of conversation that seems to be that we get either housing or trees and green space. And I think that what we need to realize is that for resilient neighborhoods, we need both. So one of the reasons why I voted against the open space amendment as it was drafted was the goal of the open space amendment was to get more density of housing on transit corridors, close to resources like groceries, jobs, education opportunities. But it didn't earmark the amount of affordability that we actually need. When it first came to us, it said it would be 80% of the area median income. So we're talking about folks making $20 to $22 an hour. And I was like, can we just start with what we actually need? If we're going to give up our open space, which is where we would plant trees or retain the tree canopy, then can we mark it for a deeper level of affordability? Because that area median income keeps crawling out of reach for the most vulnerable people in our community. What we landed on in the council meeting was that we would just match the open space amendment with the land use incentive grant policy. And we are working on the land use incentive grant policy right now. But that still didn't meet this moment, in my opinion, of needing to both repair and restore the tree canopy while getting the affordable housing that we need. So, because these are key priorities, I would like to see us as a full council, which no one council member can do this by themselves, but I would like to see us, whether it's a community benefits table, the open space amendment, the land use incentive grant, the tools that we use to incentivize getting what we need for housing, green space, tree canopy, stormwater mitigation, all of those things. Make sure we actually negotiate with what we need or better, because we're really far behind.
Okay. Sharon, in the interest of time, I'm going to jump forward a question. The purpose of the city's municipal climate action plan is to bring together previous plans and resolutions. Publication of the plan has been repeatedly delayed. Do you believe that this project meets appropriate standards for transparency and accountability? And what do you hope that the plan will achieve?
Well, I hope that it will lay out a map to get us from where we are to where we aspire to be. We are a welcoming place in the South, and we are relatively safe from extreme weather events. We have drinkable water, and we can grow food year-round. So it's unsurprising that we are a climate refuge, and that we're already seeing the impact of that. But we also, through this process of a lot of folks moving here, are seeing some of our most vulnerable neighbors displaced and have less access to resources. So if we're going to pull this off with an equity lens, I think that it's important for us to center the most vulnerable neighbors to displacement and gentrification. Does it meet the standards for transparency? I think we could always do better on that. What would it look like if we had a process as full and deep as the noise ordinance, where when we saw neighborhoods who weren't participating, we reached out to them in another way? It's not enough to just wait until it's on the agenda and do online outreach. That said, our staff are reaching out to the most vulnerable neighborhoods and are working really hard to make sure that our most impacted neighbors who will experience the worst of the outcomes of climate change are having their voice heard. So I think that that's why you see it taking more time, is we're being intentional. I think we could always do a better job messaging that to the community. And because we expect a lot of our sustainability staff, and great outcomes, we obviously, if we're going to do something, we're going to need to fund that department more to make sure they have enough staff to meet the expectations and meet this moment.
At its April 26th meeting, City Council agreed to waive nearly $80,000 in payment due to the city from Shangri-La Industries, which Council had tapped to buy and redevelop the East Asheville Ramada Inn as 100 or more affordable units. In a similar Los Angeles conversion, a Shangri-La subsidiary racked up cost overruns, delays, and a lack of transparency. How should Asheville City Council proceed with the Ramada project?
At our last meeting of council and through the check-in process, we've been watching this really closely. I'm very glad to say that the Ramada has been closed on by Shangri-La. So we are going to see it become permanently supportive housing. It's official, and they are on an accelerated timeline. They're trying to build out very quickly. So we are anticipating to see action within the year of it being able to be open and serving people. Now, with the construction delays and costs running up all over in construction, we're going to have to keep watching it closely. But the fact that they've been able to close on the property is a sign of success.
Okay. Recently, a 19-mile section of the French Broad River in Buncombe County was declared impaired, with a majority of sampled sites failing to meet the E. coli standard for safe recreation. What water quality interventions do you think the city might make?
So we have been meeting across sectors to look at which industries can we incentivize and support helping us to meet our water quality needs. A lot of it we know is stormwater runoff. So there's stormwater mitigation that needs to be happening. But the conversations that are happening on a plan that will get us from where we are to where we need to be is in the works right now. And so I'll stay at the table and hear what solutions look like, but it probably looks like finding a way to do more enforcement and more incentives to get partners to comply so that action is clearly articulated as needed because the cost is so great.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us your time today, Kim. We really try to keep the public informed through this radio show and through the radio station. So we really appreciate your putting the time in this morning.
Yes, thank you for the work that you're doing to inform the public as we near the election on November 8th.